still talking about disposition of a trial without actually, or disposition of a lawsuit without actually waiting for the trial necessarily. And so we're in the last phases, which is motions that can occur in trial and post-trial. So it's not needing the jury's verdict, really kind of doing something without it. As you should have a section in your outline or an understanding of how to join claims and one of how to join parties, you should have one about dispositions through motions. And we've covered Rule 12 before the midterm. We've compared that to summary judgment, which is now post the midterm. We're going to talk about this one in comparison to summary judgment. But you should have an understanding of what's the difference between each of these types of devices, when you would use it, how you would use it, how is the standard a little different. Because it'll help you kind of issue spot and troubleshoot for which one you're looking for. Right, so today we're going to talk about Rule 50. The other ones that are coming up for the rest of the week are 59 and 60. Rule 50 is motion for judgment as a matter of law. And there's actually two motions in this rule. The first one's in A, which is motion before the judgment, meaning before the jury returns a verdict. And it's oftentimes in state courts called directed verdicts. If you've read some of your cases in contracts and property and torts, you've probably seen these words before. You should understand that it's the same thing. The federal system in about the mid-90s changed the words that they use. They used to use these similar words to things as judgments as a matter of law to make it just consistent. But you should understand their role. The second one that occurs in 50B is also in the federal rules the same statement, judgment as a matter of law, but it's going to come at a different time. And we're going to see that you're actually going to need to use both to get what you want often, or in most cases. It's also called JNOV, which is judgment non obstante verdicto. It's just Latin. Most people call it JNOV. All right, so you should understand that that's what that one means. You'll see that a lot of state courts still use these old terms. So you should know both. You should know both. Because you'll see it in practice. Let's presume, for purposes of understanding this, that we're in our lawsuit and that Plaintiff Parsons is seeking $100,000 from Defendant Reckless for negligence. And so what we're going to ask ourselves is, can either one of these parties use Rule 50 to get to a judgment without meeting the actual jury? All right, so our first aspects of it. Who can move for judgment as a matter of law in the federal courts under Rule 50? Mr. Wolf, what do you think? Either party. So the plaintiff or the defendant, who often tends to move for this, do you think? Yeah, this tends to be more of a defensive motion. The rule doesn't limit it, and of course, just like in summary judgment motions, a lot of times parties will make an automatic, I'm going to move for judgment as a matter of law at the point in time which they can. All right, let's talk about what this means. What are we actually asking the court to do? So if we look at 50A, what is the effect if Reckless moves for judgment as a matter of law and it's granted? What does it mean for our case? Okay, so that would be like our standard we look at to decide whether we should grant it. And if we grant it, what does that mean in effect? Does the case continue? Is it over? That's right, we don't use the juries. Now realize at this point in time, the jury's been impaneled, they've been listening to all the evidence. You'll see in a moment that where we're at is the plaintiff's case in chief is just closed. So you had opening arguments, plaintiff put on their all their evidence, we've had cross-examination of all their witnesses, they're saying, you know, that's my case is closed, defendant moves for judgment as a matter of law under 50A, and the court basically says, we don't need the jury anymore. If we grant it at this point, you get a judgment, and the whole thing's over. You win. It's done. What happens if it's denied? Yeah, so then, you know, we say our motion. Well, a lot of times that 50A is orally, 50B has to be in writing. So you'll just stand up and make this motion, generally as a pro forma in a lot of cases. And so the court goes, no, deny, or a lot of times what they do is basically defer ruling on it, which is what you'll often see. And the effect of that is we go to the jury, meaning the defendant now has to put on their case and we go to the jury. What happens about the 50B? What happens if that's granted? It's a little different because we're at a different point in trial. What if a Reckless moves for a judgment as a matter of law, the renewed judgment as a matter of law under 50B? Okay.
Okay.
Okay. And what one, and we're going to talk about those in more detail, that's exactly right. What one is Reckless look, really looking for? Okay, and so what does that practically mean? What has happened? What are we looking at? The point in time this occurs, somebody's kind of already told us something. Who's spoken to us at this point in time? They've already given their evidence, and even more than that, what have we done with the case? Who's it gone to? It's already gone to the jury, and the jury's done what if Reckless is moving for this again? For who? Yeah, we won from the jury. And so if the jury had rendered a verdict in favor of Reckless, it's not going to renew his motion for judgment as a matter of law because he just got a convert. So this scenario comes up where he makes a motion earlier. He wants to renew it after the jury rules against him. So we won in the case. And so what effect is happening? If this gets granted, it means that the judge has done what with the jury verdict? Yeah, we call it vacated. You know, it's, you're not going to enter it as a judgment. You vacate that, and you enter judgment for Reckless. If it's denied, then the jury verdict gets entered as a judgment for the plaintiff, and the judgment stands. And then Reckless has really very little options at that point. He typically has to start paying out on the judgment and or appealing, and there's consequences if you don't pay out immediately because of interest and whatnot. Yes?
So is allowing judgment on the verdict, is that where the judge vacates it and like kind of does his own judgment on the verdict? I guess I don't really fully understand the first and the third one.
We're going to get to that in a second. We're just talking about if Reckless wins, what is he trying to get? And he's trying to get his judgment, which is really the third of that list. He wants judgment entered in his favor and not to give the jury verdict. But we'll get to the others in a second. We're just trying to understand the big picture process. We'll go into detail in a moment. Because I want you to kind of picture what's happening, and then we'll go through the details. All right? Does everyone understand what's happening? Defendant tried to get it not to go to the jury. The second round, it's gone to the jury. The jury's actually returned a verdict for the other side, and he's trying to say, don't put that in as the judgment. Put your own judgment, substitute it, enter it for me on this motion. That's the big picture of what's going on. And we'll talk about how they do that and the timing of when they do that and other options they might have in a moment. That's the big picture. Do we have another? I saw another hand. I thought. Okay. All right. So, again, at the large, like, broad brush stroke level, to compare this to summary judgment, how would you say it's similar or dissimilar? I think one of the big things that's different with all of these is the timing at which time the motion occurs. For summary judgment, when did it occur? Mr. Wolf, when did that occur? What phase of the trial, just generically, were we in for summary judgment? Do you remember? Yeah, it's like 30 days within the close of discovery. So you're in discovery for summary judgment. For this, we're what phase of litigation are we in now? This is trial. Trial in the last one is just immediately post-trial, 28 days after trial. So it's not a big window you have here. All right, so that also tells us a little bit about what we're actually looking at. For summary judgment, remember, you were looking at the discovery that was the pointing to, the showing, the demonstrating that there's no genuine dispute of material fact. You're looking at discovery, so it was paper record. What are you looking at when you're ruling on these motions? Yeah, you're actually, like, listening to the person who testified. You're watching it. It's the real live stuff, you know? This jury couldn't have on these guys' statements have ruled in favor. So it's you might get a different kind of answer. You might have lost the summary judgment because on a paper record we might be more willing to defer the jury. But when these people actually come in and testify, there might be now no reason to go to the jury. We thought there might have been, but now we see it. They really can't say what you think they could say. Like their affidavit wasn't as complete as we thought when we see the actual testimony. Okay? All right. So let's look a little bit at some of the specifics and some of the parts that I think cause confusion in this rule. Okay, one thing you might want to think about, since we've got the two motions and they're working together, I think one aspect that's a little odd about this is why might a judge actually deny that first motion under 50A and yet grant the renewed motion under 50B? Because remember in the first hypothetical, we talked about how they come in tandem, right? Why would you deny it and then later decide to grant it? I think to think about it, You want to think about the role of the jury and then also what the judge might have before them. Does anyone know why this is generally what happens? It's more likely to get denied on the first one and granted on the second on the new motion. Yeah. Yeah, the first thing is you don't want to interject yourself because the jury might actually get this right. I'm looking at it. You're right. There's no need to interfere. Yeah, this guy doesn't look like he's saying exactly the same thing. Let's just let the jury handle it. I'm pretty sure they can handle it. All right. There's also another reason, and it deals with appeal. Do you know why that might be? With the appellate process. You're kind of thinking about these two hypotheticals, and I think it'll start to make itself evident. What if we grant the judgment as a matter of law instead of deny it and then grant the renewed one? What if we grant that first one? Remember, it's before a judgment. Let's assume, now since it's a final judgment, it goes up on appeal.
And it gets reversed. What happens?
We have to start all over again, because remember, the jury never rendered a verdict. Because we said at the lowest of the plaintiff's case, judgment is a matter of law for the defendant. So we have to redo everything about trial. If we wait and have the jury trial, and then grant the judgment as a matter of law afterwards on the renewed motion, and we get reversed. In both cases, we're getting reversed, right? Should have granted judgment as a matter of law. But in the second scenario, what can we do? What can we do?
Just the jury verdict.
Right, we reinstate the jury verdict. Reinstate the jury verdict. Because we have a verdict from a jury. We don't have to do it all over again. So there's kind of every incentive for judges not to grant this. They're assuming the jury's going to get it right, and if they don't, they can still give you judgment. And if they're wrong and get reversed, they have to redo everything, right? All right. And the rules kind of operate sort of presuming that that's what's going to happen. Now, really, sometimes people do win on that first one if it's really painfully obvious the plaintiff is not carrying their day in court. But most often, you're doing that as a process. And it's an important process because you'll see for the renewed motion, because it's called a renewed motion, it presumes you made that first one. So it's an important process, although you don't normally win it. So let's talk about how these things time out. Okay, under 50A, let's talk about the 50A motion first. What's the earliest point in time under the rule that you can move for a 50A motion? Mr. Brenadaro? Megan?
Yep. Once the issue's been fully heard.
Okay. So the rule says when a party's been fully heard on those issues is when you can move. When's the latest time?
28 days after the jury has made their decision.
That's the renewed one. There's still a latest time for the first one. Because this one, remember, has to happen before we get the jury verdict. So it has to happen at some point then. When does it tell something? 50A2. The words it tells us. Yes, so it could really be any point in time at the latest point right before we submit to the jury, which could really be up to, like, right up until you're getting the jury instruction. So you could have, like, had the recess and then the close of evidence and come back the next day. I'll tell you that in practice, at least the court I worked for, we would always instruct the juries on the same day that we close, even if they decided that they were going to go home right after they got the instructions, because it's just easier, unless there was a big dispute about jury instructions, in which case it would be the next day. But you typically try and work that out in trial at night after the case is done for the day. You're starting to work on those issues knowing that you're coming up to instructions. And we'll talk about that in our last class. All right. So that's the earliest point in time you've been fully heard on the matter. Latest point in time before it gets submitted to the jury. So let's try a few clicker questions to see if we understand this concept. So what we're looking at before we start clicking in is the sequence of trial. And so we've got opening arguments. Then we've got plaintiff presenting their evidence. Then there's cross-examination. They continue to put new witnesses. They get cross-examination. Then they rest. Then the defendant presents their evidence. We cross each witness. They get a new witness, we cross that witness. These just kind of like go back and forth, but it's their case in chief now. They rest. Then we have closing arguments. There's rebuttal evidence before closing, if any, and it's limited to what's been opened in the scope of trial, so you can't just start putting on all your evidence. Really, the job is to put in your case in chief. The only person who can do rebuttal is the person carrying the burden, so it's the plaintiff in civil suits.
And then we have our closing arguments case gets submitted to the jury, and then we have a jury verdict. So we're assuming that this is basically the spectrum of what we have. So at the first one, if we had a judgment as a matter of law, 50A motion, who could it be made by? Here's your options. Hold on a second. Okay, your option A is nobody. Your option B is both plaintiff and defendant. Your option C is plaintiff only. Option D, defendant only. At number one, that first one up there, who could the 50A motion be made by? A, B, C, or D? Go ahead and talk with somebody. Work with which one it is. Okay, if you haven't already, please click in. Okay, good. This is no one. No one can make this motion. Why? Has anyone actually been heard on an issue? No. Opening statements do not count as being heard because what are we looking at for judgment as a matter of law? The actual evidence. And there's no evidence in an opening argument. In fact, there's an instruction. The judge often gives an instruction to the jury at the very beginning of a suit. This is not what they play for you on TV, but it's long and tedious as well as the last instructions that they get. And you can object as a lawyer as well, but it talks about what their general duties are, their role is, and it also talks about what things that they might hear. Opening and closing statements and objections. And it tells them to basically, the opening and closing, it's not evidence. It's something to think about. It's just the way you're going to cast it, but it's not evidence. And so if you can't do it, you can't move for judgment as a matter of law at that point in time. So very, very good. What about at the second phase? If we get after plaintiff presents evidence, cross, and the plaintiff rests, who can move for judgment as a matter of law at that point in time? Hold on a second. Here we go. So at number two, who can move for judgment as a matter of law? Okay, go ahead and click in. Tell me what you're thinking with this one. Go ahead and click in if you haven't already. Missing a few of you out there. All right. Okay, this one we're a little bit more split on. We've got, let's see, about 10% saying no one, 5% saying B, which is both of them. We've got, 24% saying plaintiff only, and then we have 25 people or 61, or 81, I'm sorry. No, 61%. It's tiny little numbers. 61% saying D, which is the defendant only, and that's actually the correct answer. It is D. It's the defendant only. All right, so can someone explain to me why this is a D, D answer? Those of you got it right? Yeah. No, not exactly. Right, the defendant can only move, but who has been fully heard on this issue? That's right. So the only person who has been fully heard is the plaintiff, so the defendant can move on it. Plaintiff can't move on it because the other side hasn't had a chance to be prefer. I mean, that would be really mean to be like, I finished my case in chief, and it was awesome. You don't have to worry about it. I'm going to win.
That's what it would look like. So you just think about it that way. It can't work. All right, it has to be the other side of the turn.
As far as rebuttal goes, I think it's just sort of the perception of what rebuttal is. Rebuttal is not really about being heard on your issue. It's about they've opened a door we didn't expect to be opened, so I get a chance to rebut it. So you don't normally even get a right to rebuttal unless you really have a chance to say, you know, we ventured into waters that we didn't expect them to go into. I now need to be able to rehabilitate a witness that they had put on to impeach one of mine. And so it happened after the defendant's case in chief. That's why it happens there.
So but that's a good thought as far as rebuttal goes, but that's just what rebuttal is. So you're not going to normally get that. It's really after plaintiff's case in chief, defendant gets to move, plaintiff doesn't. We're going to have that one right now. Any other questions on that? Because we had like 40% of the other answers. So is there any other questions on any of the other ones? No. Okay, let's look at the next one. So now we're at trial and the defendant has moved. They arrest and assume like there's been the opportunity for rebuttal evidence. That doesn't really shouldn't change your answer in this one either. I just kind of put it up there so that you always know it's an opportunity. But after that's done, before closing arguments, who can move for judgment as a matter of law at this point in time? What do you think? Who gets to move now? Plaintiff went up here. Defendant went. Yeah, think of it this way. It's always that way. Plaintiff, person who bears the burden, always gets to go first. They can waive that opportunity, but they always get to go first. You'll see that a lot in criminal court, actually. Prosecutors often waive the right to go. But they have it because they carry the burden. Anybody else? See where we're at now. Yay, B. That's good. All right. This one we have 84%, and it's not just because I have bad eyes. That's really 84%. Yay. Why did both get a chance to move? Both have had their chance to be heard. They both can move against the other. So plaintiff could move for judgment as a matter of law, so could defendant. So really, there's a lot more opportunities for the defendant to move. It's why it tends to be more of a defensive motion. But both can do it at this point in time. And you can also even have cross motions at this time. Cross judgment as a matter of law. Okay. All right. Then we have the case being submitted to the jury. Then we have another motion. And the verdict comes in of $100,000 judgment for the plaintiff because Parsons did a great job. So who could move at this point in time? Under 50A, who could move? Under 50A, who could move? Question is 50A. Hopefully that directs you where to go.
50A.
Under 50A, who could move? Okay. Okay, good. This is no one at this point in time. Why? The 50A motion opportunity is gone. And this is a problem because 50B will be dependent upon you making a proper 50A motion. So even for those of you who thought, oh, I can just do a 50B, that's also going to be wrong because you have to have a proper 50A, which we'll get to in a second, okay, because it's renewed motions. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Just look and tell me which one you think.
I don't understand how
the city would move. Okay. Like, why it would come up that way? Okay. It's less of a, it's more like what it is since the plaintiff carries the burden ultimately in the trial, that they have to prove by a preponderance of evidence that the things are what you say they are. So let's think of it in the context of Parsons. It's our burden to show all the elements of negligence, that he owed us a duty, that he breached it using unreasonable care when he drove, that he caused the damages we've shown. And if any one of those pieces can't be proved by a preponderance of the evidence, in this situation, the defendant is really standing up and saying they didn't do what they said they were going to do. They couldn't meet their burden. Because if you look at who's testified as to what, let's presume, here, I'll give you some facts. Let's presume all the witnesses that we had in the affidavits who said, I think he swerved, that under cross-examination, every single one of those, you know, I was really distracted because there was, you know, a person climbing the building on one of those little sucking cup people up the skyscraper next to me. I was looking at him instead. Every single one of them says that. And so then you can start to say, look, there's not even a question that the jury could conclude for breach beyond, you know, the preponderance of the evidence standard to be at a guess, because all the witnesses who filed their affidavits, in fact, were not perceiving in the way they said they were. Okay, so we might have survived summary judgment, but when the day comes, what they can testify to doesn't support enough to get past the preponderance standard. But I'll tell you, in actuality, since most judges won't grant this to you, what you're doing is actually preserving your right to make a motion after the judgment comes out against you. So while you are hoping for judgment, what you're generally doing is giving yourself an opportunity to ask for the judgment when it's rendered against you to be vacated. So it just kind of gives you, and we'll tell you why we make you do this in a second, but that's what you're really doing. So it's they haven't shown their day at court. They haven't shown by the standard, preponderance of the evidence, their elements. All right, and then the defendant gets up and then gives their own evidence of why they are in breach. And then they can move even at that point in time and say, look, look at their evidence, look at my evidence. No jury could conclude anything other than I drove carefully. All right. If you look at the last one, the number five motion, we're at post-trial within 28 days of entry of the judgment. This is actually the 50B motion. So 58 doesn't occur this far out. It's the renewed motion at this point in time, or we might have other motions later that you'll learn about, 59 and 60, vacating a judgment, getting a new trial. But at this point, you're in 50B, so there is no movement under 58 at this point yet.
Can you move for 58 more than once?
Mm-hmm.
And is there like a limit to how many times you can do it?
No, it's just you. The only opportunities you're going to have as the defendant is after plaintiff's case in chief, after your case in chief, before it's submitted to the jury. So technically, it's really twice. I mean, you could be moving at it. As the defendant, you really could keep moving it after every single witness you put in because they've been fully heard on the matter, but you typically will do it once or twice. Now, it used to be there was a different rule. So if you're looking at an old outline, prior to 2006, you had to make your motion to preserve it for renewal at the close of all evidence. So what used to happen is if you made it at that second point, you also had to make it again at 3, or you wouldn't preserve it. It was like the super, super make sure we know you're going to renew this kind of thing. But then the rules change, and you don't have to do that. As long as you've made one before the case is finished, made 150A motion, you're going to be okay. It's going to be fine. If you're looking at old outlines from students, or if you're looking at like old study aids pre-2006, which we're looking at, that's wrong. It doesn't have to happen at number 3 in order to preserve it. Okay? Most people do. Most people do. Especially if there's, you know, they just don't want to risk the chance that the jury is going to come out against them. Because what you're trying to do is prevent, like, appeal. You want to just win, okay? And so a lot of people do. Just like summary judgment motions, a lot of this motion practice becomes, like, as a litigator, every case that you get to trial, you file it. Well, anytime you file any paper before the court, you're subject to Rule 11 sanctions. And we'll see that 50B is actually a written statement before the court. 50As are not. They can be orally done right in court, and they typically are. And it's fairly standard. You'll say, what happens in almost every single case is plaintiff rests, defendant moves for judgment as a matter of law. And the court goes, no. And they sit down, and we continue on. I mean, it's sort of just like, you know, the, hi, how you doing? I've done my basic deeds as a lawyer. You pretty much always make one of these. Especially in, like, high-stakes litigation, there's no reason you wouldn't. Sometimes they make it later if they really think that they've, like, shown that you don't need a jury. But they know that the judge is disinclined to grant these before the jury returns because it's going to be a waste of time if they get reversed on appeal and they're hoping the jury just does it for them. They don't want to have to take it away. Remember, the judge does not want to invade the role of the jury. If the jury gets it right, we don't have to worry about it. So it's more of a process thing, but it's a very important process thing because, and here's the next slide, if you don't, you get into trouble. 50B
has a requirement. If you look at it, what must the movement have done to be entitled to post-judgment relief in that last motion, to make the 50B motion? Is it A, make a 50A motion at any time before the case is submitted to the jury? B, make a 56 summary judgment motion at the end of discovery? C, make a 50B renewal motion within 28 days. Used to be 10, I apologize, I didn't find that one. Days after the entry of judgment, and which one do you think it is? So you've got A, B, C, D, E, and F. And I'll put them up here. This one's on your worksheet, so just go ahead and click on this one. I'll give you 30 seconds there. What do you have to do to be entitled to post-judgment relief? What do you have to do to be entitled to post-judgment relief? See yourself. There you go. Good job, everybody. Yeah, scratch out your sheet and put 28 on that one. All right, good. Everyone has this one right, so we don't need to belabor it. Hopefully you found out by this point in time. You need to both make an initial motion, and then you need to make your next one. It has to be within 28 days of the judgment of the jury. The other part of the rule says when the jury's been discharged, there are certain things sometimes we don't actually require a jury verdict on. And if it's been anything like that, once the jury's out for 28 days, you've had to make a judgment as a matter of law at that point in time. So 28 days. Very short period of time. Very short period of time. So two musts I would have in my outline. One, make a 50A motion for judgment as a matter of law at any time prior to submission to the jury. And two, renew that motion 28 days after the entry of judgment. All right, so here's another diagram for you. Which motion, if it alone was made by the defendant, does not entitle the defendant to a 50B renewal? So if you look at this one, which motion... if you click 2, 3, or 4, 2 is up here, opening arguments, plaintiff's evidence, D, judgment as a matter of law, and then we've got number 4 here is when the case is being submitted. Which motion, if it was made alone by the defendant, does not entitle them to a renewal? Which one of these? So you've got 2, 3, and 4. Okay, do you understand what we're saying? Which one, if they only made that one, would not entitle them to be able to make the 50B motion? Which one's not going to be good enough? Which one doesn't count as preserving your right to renew? Would you like to think of that one? Which one won't count as preserving your right to renew? Which one would not count as preserving your right to renew? Go ahead and click in on this one if you haven't. Yeah, B, C, D. Yeah. It won't let me pick the numbers. Yeah, I'm sorry. So it should be B, C, and D as far as the letters go. Okay, so go ahead and click in. Okay, good. That one is the one that won't count. The other ones will count. And the reason I point that out, too, is you will find old hypos from students. I know they pass on outlines, and no one writes in there conveniently, hey, I took the class in this year and checked to make sure the rules haven't changed, even though I know all of you would be like Johnny on the spot of, I'm not going to trust any old legacy outline. As my class, all the rules have changed. But if you haven't, they'd have a different answer. Because in 2006, the answer would have been both 2 and 4 would not have been good enough. You had to move at that number 3, 2006, up to 2006, you had to move at number 3. So I say that because I always see, or I did on the midterm, see some of the old rules. Make sure you don't have that one. Yes?
Is 4 even allowed?
No. Okay. That's why it will not count. Yes?
Can you explain why it's not allowed?
Because at this point, the case has already been submitted to the jury. So it has to be a valid one, which means sometime after the person's been heard on the issue, but before it's submitted to the jury. So only two valid ones you have are 2 and 3, and now, post-2006, both are good enough. Pre-2006, only 3 would have been good enough. That's why I highlighted it. Okay? And if you do any research on practice, if you're looking at cases pre-2006, we'll have it written the other way. All right. Let's look at one other issue. Okay, it seems kind of odd, if we're not going to really grant it for you, that we make you make this motion. Make you stand up and say, I'd like to move for judgment as a matter of law, and they said, sit back down. Because that's pretty much what happens. Why do we make you do that?
Is it just because we love process? Maybe. But the reality is, I think it's notice. And it also deals with something really important, the Seventh Amendment right to jury trial. Now, the reality is, the Seventh Amendment tells us that no fact tried to a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States other than according to the rules of common law. So this applies to the federal courts and basically says we can't undo what the jury has done.
But it sure seems like that's what we're doing, isn't it?
So the renewal process allows us to employ a fiction, if it were. We're not really undoing what the jury did. We're just revisiting the motion you made before. All right?
And it's going to get more uncomfortable when we talk about vacating judgments, but the courts have upheld that as well. That there are points in time where we're going to say, not so much that the jury got it right, but that looking at it objectively, no reasonable jury could have decided this.
And I know, we're parsing things finally.
Welcome to process. All right? But that's why we have this fiction still. The other reason we have the fiction is it gives you notice.
If you're the plaintiff and someone stands up and says, I'm going to move for judgment as a matter of law, you should be aware that after trial, if you win, you should expect the motion coming back to you. You should expect. Because that's what they've done. They've told you, if the jury says you win, it's not over for you. So normally, if you're a litigator, trial is like one of the most intense periods of your life. You pretty much don't see anybody you know for quite some time. You're kind of like in the trial. And one of the things you're already doing is drafting these things coming up. You already know what your responses are going to be. So you litigate during the day, you talk to the jury during the day, at night you're dealing with this stuff. All right, but that's what you do. So that's why we have it. You should know, because I like to ask these questions, that this has to happen. You have to have a motion before you get to renew it. Okay. One other side note is the 28-day rule. They made it a little bit nicer. It used to be 10 days. You should note, as you're looking at the rules to kind of give yourself a sense of policy and come back to it, the things before we got to trial, before we got to the jury's role, we gave you a lot more time. A lot of time to amend, you know, 21 days, a lot of time after discovery, the 30 days to move for summary judgment. As we get closer to post-trial, we make it tighter, and we give you no extensions of time. Under Rule 6, you can ask for extensions of time. This one is one of the ones you cannot ask for extension of time. So you need to be, when you're litigating, you are really working hard because you're planning for all this stuff. Because you're not going to be able to go, well, I just need a break for a little while so I can file my motion for summary judgment, or motion for judgment as a matter of law, now that I've had a breather after trial. Because the rules don't allow it. They don't allow for extensions. Why? Because we consider like finality to be an important thing in the process. And so the longer we allow that jury verdict to potentially be not entered, the more upset we get. The process is not like that. We like to have finality. Before trial, sure. Litigate all you want. Spend as much time as all you want. Once we've had a jury and have a decision, we want it to be entered. Okay. Let's look at our hypos on our sheet to talk about two other kind of sub-issues here. This first one, we kind of talked about defendant reckless moves for judgment as a matter of law at the close of all evidence. After the verdict for plaintiff Parsons, the court enters judgment for Parsons. Defendant reckless does not get around to filing and serving a motion until 30 days after the entry of judgment. And I just lectured that one, so is that one proper? No. So if you were to answer it, did he do anything right?
Or reckless? He did. What did he do right?
He had that initial motion, he had the 50A, and that's important to note. He did do that right, because he could have had two things wrong, and so he should have been issue spotting two things on the exam if I gave you.
So if I changed it where he did it, like, after it had been submitted to the jury, he wouldn't have had a 50A. He has a proper 50A motion.
See? After the close of all the evidence, he did it at stage 3 in our little chart, he moves for judgment as a matter of law. Okay? What he did wrong, though, is the renewed motion comes too late. 28 days, and it's an absolute. Okay? All right, let's look at the next one. At the close of all evidence, defendant reckless moves for judgment as a matter of law, simply stating, Your Honor, Plaintiff Parsons just hasn't proved her case. This motion is denied. Following the verdict and judgment for Parsons, defendant Reckless again moves for judgment as a matter of law. Is that proper? Megan, I'm going to come back to you for just a second here. What do you think about what he did?
I think this would be proper.
Okay, why do you think this is proper?
Because he did the 50A before he went to jury, and then he moved forward again after.
Right after the verdict. So the timing is definitely right. What else is going on in this question, though? What other things do you see factually happening? Any new facts that we haven't seen in our other hypos yet? Yes, and so what we want to do, and the reason I'm asking you is I think it's a good way to think about issue spot in the exam. Sometimes one issue you're thinking about, I'm thinking about timing, and I want to answer that. But when I write questions, all the facts I give you I intend to be used. I don't have a lot of like background facts. I don't intend to have red herrings. So if you see something like, okay, if I give you what he's saying, there's something in that too. So let's think about that. He says, Your Honor, Plaintiff Parsons just hasn't proved her case. All right, so we have to ask ourselves, is that sufficient under the rules? And so when does he say that? He says that one at the close of all evidence. So which motion was that one, the 50A or the 50B? Okay, so let's look at 50A and ask whether or not that was sufficient. You see in 50A anywhere where they tell us of how the motion should be made? It's not much more than this you have to do, but he didn't quite get it right. What? Yeah, exactly. So if you look at A2, you have to specify the law and facts that entitle you to judgment as a matter of law. Did he do that? No, because you don't see any reference to the law or the facts that would show it. Now, realize at this phase, there's not a requirement it's in writing. It can be in writing. The second one, 50B, there's an implicit requirement it's in writing because they talk about it being... Does anyone see any word in there? That might help us figure out that that one needs to be written. Does anyone see the word? It would be nice if they put it writing, but they didn't put that word in there. They say file. And file means it has to be in writing. Okay, so that one has to be in writing. In a lot of practice, people write both of them because it's the same motion twice. So there's no need to just be sloppy in the first because you don't necessarily have to have it. But you have to do a little bit more than just say, I move. Although I'll tell you in practice, it's not a whole lot more. Yeah.
So you had said earlier that a lot of times...
It's pretty quick. He'd have to say...
Have to be in writing?
This one doesn't have to be. This one doesn't have to be. It can be. And sometimes people write them ahead of time because B has to be in writing. Yeah.
So are we saying here that the 50B one, the rule, is improper because the 50A one was sloppy?
Yes, that's exactly what we're saying. The 50A didn't meet the standard, and you have to have like a good, valid, meets all the requirements of 50A to be able to renew it.
Is that like a third and implicit requirement for 50B
renewal? No, I guess I just see it as for the first requirement, you have to make a valid 50A. And we're just now finishing fleshing out what a valid 50A looks like. Yeah, it has to both meet. We haven't, the other thing we haven't talked about still, the standard. It also has to show it meets the standard, has to be timed appropriately, has to be the right format, which is specified. Yes.
Could they be allowed to make a 50A motion not saying that, and maybe the 50B one that does meet the requirements?
No, because 50A also has to have something to it. But realize the specificity that's required is not much more than stating what aspect of the law you think they have improved. Like, how can we fix this? I actually think you would have met 50A if you'd said they didn't prove breach because none of the witnesses say that I swear.
Okay.
It's not a whole lot more, but it has to at least identify for the court why. Just saying, because they didn't do their job, is not good. In best practice, you can file it and then file it again. But A doesn't actually require that, in part because they understand you're in the middle of litigation. Yes.
So you just say that you would submit a brief with this?
You could. You don't have to. B has to be written.
So your motion would include some facts, things like that. It wouldn't just be a couple sentences.
It depends on what you're moving for and how complex the law is. Like, if it's really, like, they have shown no duty. Let's say we had, instead of a car accident, we had a case on land. And the only type of situation you can show is that everybody talks about him as a trespasser. And we're in a state that doesn't provide, you know, recovery under a negligence standard to trespassers. Then all we have to say is they've entered no evidence to support that they're anything but a trespasser. Therefore, I win.
You might have gotten over this already.
That's
I just want to make sure I had this. So, if the motion's denied and it was in proper form, you can bring the 50B. But if the motion's denied and you didn't do it in proper form, you can't bring the 50B.
Right. 50B...
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
And does the court tell you if you met the standard in it when it says denied? Does it say that you...
They don't have to. I'll tell you, like, what it normally is denied. So chill. Denied. Sit down. We'll go on. That's what it really looks like. I'll tell you, that's what it looks like. But that doesn't mean that the opposing party, when they're responding in writing to your 50B motion, won't nitpick everything you did. So, I mean, you just need to be aware of what the practice is so that you can respond to it. You know, like I said, in litigation, you know, you cannot just say, I'm in the middle of trial, I can't think about these future events. You pretty much are planning them simultaneously. So some people write their initial motion. It's just not required by the rules. It can be orally. The second one has to be in writing. Some people write it because it's just the renewed motion. It's literally the same thing. In fact, they kind of put a new title on it. Maybe point to the evidence that they now put into trial. It's the same thing. They can be brought all together. As long as you specifically state the reasons for your judgment.
So then when you do a 50B on, like, just one, you can just say, I agree
with
on this.
As long as you've made that issue, that fact, and that basis of law in your first motion, it's now renewed. It just has to be made in the first motion. That's in part why we require you to do some specificity. Otherwise, you could just, you know, not have anything. Then there's no notice to the plaintiff whatsoever about deficiencies. I mean, think about it. If you're really saying, like, I couldn't prove breach, then I at least have the opportunity still at this point in time to put on rebuttal evidence about that. Where I don't have that opportunity if it's already done. Okay. That's kind of part of it, but it's not entirely, because some of it happens at the close of all evidence where you really don't have a lot of opportunity to fix anything. But again, it's sort of just a process point. You should just know you should do it with enough specificity so they can identify what you're moving on. Okay, so let's look about the standard now. The standard comes in two parts. A reasonable jury would not have a legally sufficient evidentiary basis to find for the plaintiff on, or that party on that issue. So the court resolves the issue against the party, and that claim or defense under controlling law can be maintained or defeated only with a favorable finding on the issue. So if we think about it in our situation, let's use Parsons and spell out what that would look like in how you'd argue it, how you'd write about it, and in an exam, what does it look like? Well, for A, we'd have to say that there's, reckless would have to say that there's no reasonable jury that would... be able to find on this evidentiary basis that Parsons had an aspect for claim. And we've been playing with the breach element, so let's just focus on that. So you'd say no reasonable jury looking at these facts, hearing this testimony, could conclude that he acted improperly, he swerved. And the second part, for her claim, she needs to show breach to win. That's what it means. The second part means your claim or your defense under controlling law can be maintained only with a favorable finding on an issue. You can only win negligence if you can favorably show the defendant breached a duty of care. So all you have to do is say, nobody could find reasonably based on this evidence that I swerved. That's her theory of recovery. She needs to prove breach to win. She can't win. I'm entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Understand that? Okay, is it same or different standard for 50B? It's a renewed motion, so it's the same. Which is often why you're preparing for 50A, you're really just setting up for 50B. Okay? At least you should be thinking about it, nothing else. All right, it's the same standard, so you'd argue the same things in your brief. Let's compare it for a moment with summary judgment, because this will get us a little into our Reeves case. All right, if you look at it in summary judgment, no genuine dispute of material fact and you're entitled to judgment as a matter of law, you look across the page, it's the same thing, basically. It's the same standard. What's different? It's what we're looking at. It's what we're looking at. Remember, for genuine issue material fact, it was no evidence that a reasonable jury could find for the non-moving party based upon the record evidence. Now what we're looking at is the same kind of idea, but based upon the evidence actually entered in dispute. So let's look at our Reeves case. We'll see how this is applied, and then we'll kind of be done. Okay, in Reeves, this is there's a lot of Reeves that's not relevant to Civ Pro. So we try to step through on the worksheet the issues that were there. It's about age discrimination. And age discrimination is tricky because it's got a shifting burden throughout it, so we try to work closely to it and kind of identify it. You start out with the plaintiff has to prove a prima facie case, which means that they have to show that, one, they're in the discriminated class, and since it's age discrimination, you have to show that you're at least at the age limit, and it's 40 under the time that they had this particular claim. You also have to show that you were qualified for the position you were discharged from. You have to show that they then filled it with someone who was in a different age bracket, a younger one, for your position. Because basically what you're trying to show is, I otherwise was qualified for the job. The only reason they discharged me was because they wanted to hire someone younger. Once you do that, the burden shifts to the defendant of production. So they have to produce, come forward with a legitimate, non-discriminatory explanation. And here, why did they say in the hinge room this guy needed to go? Because he was not keeping accurate reports of the attendance of the people that were underneath him. And the way that they paid people was literally how long you were sitting on the line. So if he would mark someone in when they weren't really there at 7, they were falsely paying people. And so that led to a lot of problems. Disgruntled employees, because, you know, Molly comes in and she gets paid, but she's in here at 7:30. She's getting paid from 7 on. I'm not. That's problems with the union. All right? And so they also said he falsified the records. After, and this happens in all discrimination cases, after you do that, then the burden shifts back to the plaintiff. Because now the plaintiff has been given an opportunity to know what they're up against. And they have now the burden to show that that's pretextual. And that's a term of art. It just means that you're lying. That's what it means. You're lying. You didn't really discharge me for the records and attendance. You discharged me because I was too old for the job. You discriminated against me. So that's why it's a pretext for discrimination. It's a good false front. Because you're not going to get up there and say, we fired you because you were old. You get up there and say, we fired you for some legitimate purpose. We're saying that's just false front. That's pretext. It's a fake reason. A good, nice-sounding fake reason, but a fake reason. You really discharged me because I was too old. All right, so here, ultimately, the burden always rests with the plaintiff to prove their case. The jury rendered a verdict in favor of the plaintiff, so the defendant moves for judgment as a matter of law. The trial court denies judgment as a matter of law, but the Fifth Circuit reverses and grants it. And it's basically along the lines that they said, when we look at the evidence, we're only looking at this part of the dispute. And so we're just looking at the motivation evidence, like all the mean, nasty things the supervisor said about old people and to you. We're not looking at what he disputed about the reason for termination. He was saying the records were actually accurate. You know, the time clock wasn't working, so I would write in there, the start time is 7 o'clock, but these people literally did get here sooner. The time clock just didn't punch them in. All right, so the Supreme Court tells us in a very long decision that you look at all the evidence. Okay, why is it in your casebook, and why belabor the point? Well, I only assign one of these two cases to give you some context, neither of which are particularly helpful. The cases in prior casebooks I've used, equally frustrating for students. So, this was kind of the best out of all options we had. The other one was a case about a cow that got hit by a railroad. And aside from that particular image, no one remembered anything about judgment as a matter of law. So I thought, well, I guess this is at least something, and you're going to learn about a very common type of suit in federal courts. Discrimination is sort of their bread and butter. There are lots and lots of them. But to see why we're reading it is this idea of the standard. Could a reasonable jury have not legally found, based on this evidence, for the party on that issue? Remember, they found for the person who was being discriminated against. Was it so against him that a reasonable jury could have found for him on that issue? The Supreme Court reverses here and reinstates the trial judge's decision that, in fact, it was not something that was unreasonable, that the defendants weren't entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Why do you think that was? Do you remember any of the facts that suggest a reasonable jury, even if we would differ looking at the evidence, could have said, yeah, this is really about discrimination based upon all the evidence proffered? What maybe helped out the plaintiff here? Yeah. And other people testified about the time clock issue. Right. What else? Anything else? And they said, you weren't reprimanding people. He said, hey, that's not part of my job description. He had some pretty good evidence throughout. And then all that hostile comments were made specifically to him. And everyone said, yeah, this guy was a mean supervisor, but he's really mean to old plaintiff. Okay? Really mean to him. All right. So in the end of the day, the basic question is, you know, will the existence of some evidence for the non-moving party preclude a 50 JMOL? Not necessarily. It's not like just a scintilla, just a little tiny amount of evidence, but it's such that it wouldn't be reasonable for the jury. So remember when we were in summary judgment and there's that big spectrum where you can make a judgment call? That's where we're at here. Now realize what's going to be the over-prevailing kind of theme. We don't like to strip issues from the jury. We don't like to strip issues from the jury. So you generally want to presume everything in favor of the jury verdict. So our last question that we had on the worksheet, the answer should be the last one. Must the jury determination of credibility? Yes, you have to accept the jury's determination of credibility. So, and this is a summary question, the first two. Then the court looks at all the evidence. It should consider, one, should it consider all the evidence that supports the non-movement? Yes, and in their favor, because they're trying to oppose the judgment. And C, all the evidence that supports the movement that's uncontradicted or unimpeached. So what you're basically saying is movement, you have to, everything's moved against you. It's all in favor of the person who won at the jury, So everything in favor of the non-moving party, the person who won at the jury. And anything that you put on that wasn't impeached. All right, very good. I'll leave that last typo. I can post some notes about it on in the one in the casebook, 10.3, if you have any questions about it or if you want to post an answer. That will be on Twitter.